History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories right there that we cannot allow to go untold. If we'll just invest a little time, ask a few questions, and really just sit and listen, we're going to be very thankful we did. And I don't know about you, but that's how I feel every week as we honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We preserve their stories so the rest of us will never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And we definitely learn a lot when we start down that path. Not only are we educated, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The gentleman we have the privilege of meeting today was the Grand Marshal of the Independence Day Parade this summer in Bakersfield, California. 93-year-old Charlie Wilson served in the U.S. Army Air Corps during World War II, a radio man on C-47 and C-54 transport planes throughout the Pacific. He helped deliver supplies and evacuate wounded soldiers when he wasn't sneaking into the officers' club by switching identities with his pilots. Of course, that also sometimes got the pilots into the NCO club, so they all had the best of both worlds. The training he received and the expertise he developed during his World War II service would enable Charlie to land a role in the March to the Moon. We're going to hear about all that, as well as the two times in his life that he's parachuted out of airplanes. They came more than 70 years apart. One was planned, one was not. So we have a lot to look forward to today with 93-year-old Charlie Wilson. Let's start out way back when you were a little guy in West New York, New Jersey. Is that really a place, West New York, yeah. New Jersey?
I could tell you a little side issue about that. It has nothing to do with this interview. I had, really, this is true. I had occasion to go on one of the veterans' speeches, talking to some school kids. Uh-huh. And they had, I was up on the stage with the rest of the guys, and we happened to have a guest speaker there was a 2-star general from the Air Force that retired, and he was the guest speaker. He came from the same town, went to the same public school, and when we knew the streets, he lived 2 blocks from where I lived. You know, can you imagine that? 70 years later, 2,000 miles, talk about coincidence. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, what are the odds of that?
Yeah, exactly right. Now, this is true, and this only happened maybe about 6 months ago. And on occasion, when they were dedicating Minter Field for a 100-year anniversary, he was the speaker. They had a dinner, and the guest speaker was a female test pilot testing out the new aircraft they have out there, the F-35. And he introduced me as well there, but that's the story. He says, I'm going to tell you a little story before blah, blah, blah. You know, and he told exactly the same story. He says, get up, Charlie. And I go, okay, wait, you know. And then I started the regular things. Can you imagine that? A 2-star general. Oh, my God. I didn't know whether to click my heels and salute him or what.
Well, and that really is a needle in a haystack. But most of us have never been to West New York, New Jersey. So tell me what that was like growing up there in the 20s and 30s.
Well, it was a typical small town, but just to let you know where it is. Now, the most common thing that happened there was the aircraft into the Hudson River. On one side of the Hudson River was Manhattan Island. The other side was the Palisades, which are cliffs. And on top of that is West New York. So that more or less tells you where it is. So it's between the Lincoln Tunnel and the George Washington Bridge along the Palisades. And the Palisades are the name of the cliffs they had there. Maybe about 50, 100 feet high, nothing real big about it. But that's where West New York was, right there.
So what kind of stuff were you up to as a kid?
Oh, the usual kid stuff. You know, going to school, playing hooky. Got caught by a truth officer once. And that's where they invented the game of recent folks might remember, the chip on the shoulder. And you often hear that as an expression in today's lingo. And what it is that you're ready to start a fight. And what it was, and this is the way it actually worked, as I recall it, the guy who wants to start the fight, the bully of the yard, He'd put a literal chip on his shoulder, chip a piece of wood on his shoulder, and he'd challenge you. And if you hit that wood off, that means you wanted to fight him. Well, you're walking around with a chip on your shoulder. You're looking for trouble. That's what it relates to today. Well, after getting belted a few times, you know, my mother says, my sainted mother, oh, boy, she knew more things. She says, when he puts a chip on your shoulder, don't knock it off. Belt him. Because you know if you do, you're going to get whacked. So whack him first. And I did. Uh-huh. I still got whacked, but it was they didn't play that game with me too much because they figure, you know. So anyway, back in the days, we had our bullies. And that's the way we took care of them.
Well, and I know I've seen a photo of you in a Angels uniform from one of their fantasy camps. So I know you love the game of baseball and you played growing up. What was it like to be a boy outside of New York City when the Yankees were there and the Giants were there and the Dodgers were there? I mean, it must have been heaven.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. And not only that, but in Jersey City, they had the Jersey City Giants for the minor league team. And so when we couldn't get over across the river, we would go down to Jersey City and watch them. But I tell you, one of the interesting things I've seen, now I don't know how true it is, maybe I'm fantasizing, but I'd go over to Dodger Ebbets Field over at Flatbush. I've seen some weird things there. And probably the weirdest and most enjoyable thing is the Dodger band. You ever hear the Dodger band?
No.
You never did?
Uh-uh.
Oh, that's a story that is in Dodger history someplace. What it was, just ordinary fans, they all had instruments and they played them like that. And they'd come down and they'd get the front row seats right down the third baseline, right on the field. And I know trombone or sax or the trumpet or something like that. And they play lively music. But the minute the Dodgers screwed up, they played the same tunes in flat, the entire flat, because they were not happy about it. And if they did something good, then they played some song straight. And it was a nice little melody. But the minute some guy would make an error or they'd run into each other, you could hear the song going flat. It was classic. It really was. And these guys would come in, and they would just do it for the sake of having some fun with them. And I remember at Dodgers. And probably, I don't remember if this is true or not, but my mind is, thinking about it. Here's two guys on the Dodgers team standing on second base, and they're fighting as to who belongs there. But I got it. No. Those were the baseball games. Those were real, real games. At least I enjoyed them.
Sounds like an Abbott and Costello routine, kind of. Did you have a favorite player back in those days?
Yeah, I had a player that I liked from the Yankees. Oh, Heinrich, the guy out in right field. The unsung hero. That guy could play the outfield. He was a respectable hitter, but he was playing in the shadow of Joe DiMaggio and a couple of those other guys. But I just liked him. He was just a good ball player.
And like so many ball players from that era, he would also serve in World War II. Tommy Henrich was an all-star before and after the war. He served in the U.S. Coast Guard and ended up playing baseball for Coast Guard teams for the better part of 3 years during the war before returning to the Yankees and playing in the all-star game in each of his final 4 seasons in the majors. So Yankee aficionados and old-time baseball buffs know about Tommy Henrich, but I want to know about Charlie Wilson. How good a ball player were you?
You're asking me on how good I think I was? Oh, come on. There's nobody better than me. I can muff more balls than anybody, but very fashionable. No, I was a respectable fielder, but the one thing I had was I had going for me was I had a relatively strong arm. I was a puny kid. If I'm playing ball, I was only, about 145, 150 pounds. I was slow as hell. Oh, slow. When we had the trial runs going from home place down to first base like that, they used to time me with an egg timer. But the one thing I had better than anybody was the first 2 steps. I'd beat anybody. And that's why they hung me on third. And I was a respectable fielder, but they put me on third because when that ball comes down, that's all you got time is for one, maybe 2 steps, and then it's gone. Being an announcer, I'm sure you understand I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And if it takes a bad hop, you get it right in the chops.
The hot corner, that's what they call it. Let's talk about this. So most of us alive today, not only did we not live through World War II, we didn't live through the Great Depression. And we've never seen in this country anything else like that. So can you help us understand what that was like from your vantage point?
Oh, yeah. But of course, you got to remember that as I'm speaking, how old was I? Maybe about 8 or 9, maybe about that. So I'm going back deep. The only thing that I remember from that, and this goes back to before we got one on air, I was telling you about the general I met, came from West New York,
yeah.
You know, and we went to public school. Well, right next to that public school, they have the old-fashioned blacksmith shop. And I still remember very vividly where they were still doing the local horses, because they still had horses there at that time pulling the trolleys, and they would be fixing the steel rims on the wheels. But what the thing was, if they got to like you, the two guys that were running the blacksmith shop, they would make you a horseshoe ring, a horseshoe nail ring, from the actual horseshoe nail, you know, and they'd get it hot, and they'd get it on the anvil and start to bang it, and they put your hand out, and they start to fit it on until it fits your finger, and they made it especially for you. Man, you were in. Everybody didn't get one of those things, and they didn't make it for all the kids. But if you got one, that means that you knew somebody. And I had a couple of those things. I wish I had them now, because I'm sure there must be some kind of collector's items.
Did you have a sense of how hard those times were, or were there things that your family had to do just to get by because times were so tough?
Oh, yeah. Well, just about my whole family. The best thing to say, I'm going to regress slightly, the one thing that more or less saved us was the old WPA and the CCC camps. I had a couple of uncles came out west here to work in the forest here as part of the Conservation Corps. And I had other relatives that were working locally on projects of the WPA to build the bridges and fix this and fix that. And that more or less kept things going, because they at least had a job and they were working, and that did work. But I'll tell you something, and to this day, the restaurant they have here, the owners prior to the one that owns it now, I gave them a kind of coffee that I used to get from Depression days. And they said, how do you make it? See, and they even named it after me and put it on the menu. Yeah, they're called the New York Charlie, they put it. Well, yeah. What is it? Well, in essence, because back then, you didn't throw coffee or anything else away. You couldn't afford to buy it. But what you did, you learned how to doctor it. So what they did was made the kind of a latte you find today, but this coffee would be about a day old, and it's black and bitter. But that would be about 1.5 inches from the bottom of the cup. Mm-hmm. And then the top part was milk, but simmered. And back then, we didn't have 2%, 1%. You got milk, you got milk. The only thing you can get besides that was skim, say. But otherwise, you got regular milk. You put that right on top of that tough coffee, that rough coffee, with a little dash of whipped cream on the top and some sprinkle of sugar, and it's good. It was good. And so I had to make that, exactly that recipe here. Uh-huh. And they actually put it on the menu, and I'd come in every morning, and they'd be waiting for me to give me my New York Charlie.
Uh-huh.
And it was made exactly that. And I remember that from the Depression days.
So if I were to come here tomorrow to the lodge at the Four Seasons in Bakersfield and ask for the New York Charlie, they'd make that for me?
They probably would. They probably would.
And what about as you're growing up, your boyhood years, your teenage years, was there something you had in your mind, an ambition, a dream, a target? Hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do with my life?
Well, essentially, no, until I got through the service, because there is where I got my first education, technical training, so to speak. And so I took to it very well. I had to take a test before they would send me there, because when I went in listed as a student. But after passing some of their IQ tests and some of their other written tests that they gave, they said, okay, you'll make a good radio man. What do I know? I just learned how to start to turn it on, much less I'm now going to learn how to run it, fix it, Morse code, and run all this expensive equipment. 18-year-old kid running all that equipment, unheard of.
And just think about how many of those 16 million Americans who served in our armed forces in World War II were teenagers just like Charlie. It's time for our first break, but we still have plenty to cover with Charlie Wilson of Bakersfield, California. You've heard a lot lately about the first manned moon landing because of the 50th anniversary of that Apollo 11 mission, but you may not remember, or if you weren't born yet, you might not be aware, that there were unmanned missions to the moon before that. It was all part of the puzzle, and we're going to hear what Charlie's contribution to all that was. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video of Charlie, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're going to dive back in with Charlie Wilson in a moment, but I hope you'll humor me with a brief detour here because I happened to look at the calendar. And, you know, the 50th anniversary of Neil Armstrong's first steps on the moon has been in the news lately. Before that, we were talking about the 75th anniversary of D-Day, maybe the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Saipan in the Pacific, and over the course of the next year, there will be several more significant 75th anniversaries relating to World War II. But for me personally, the most significant 75th anniversary takes place this next week on August 1st. Because if the events of August 1st, 1944, for the 6th Armored Division near Pont-Orsan, France, had gone a little differently, I would not be interviewing Charlie Wilson today. I wouldn't be interviewing anybody. One of the first veterans whose stories I tried to capture when I started doing this 15 years ago on television was my grandfather, Dr. Robert Leffler, who passed away in 2008. His actions on August 1st, 1944, were courageous enough to earn him the Silver Star. Pretty unusual for an Army doctor. When a column of tanks and half-tracks were ambushed by German 88s, my grandpa and his Jeep driver pulled 26 men out of burning vehicles. As enemy fire continued to rain down on that position, they returned to the scene multiple times in their effort to save lives. So when I asked him 60 years later on TV what he was thinking during those intense, life-threatening moments, he shared a pretty sobering reality in his typical humorous fashion.
I was pretty sure I was going to get killed.
Well, I'm glad you didn't.
Yeah, you wouldn't be around.
And that reality, that I wouldn't be around, that I would have never been born, that I would never have had the privilege of meeting a single World War II veteran, let alone all the amazing men and women we get to hear from on Hometown Heroes, that realization has been a driving force for me ever since. That wasn't his only close call in the war, but the Silver Star was his highest decoration, and those heroics took place 75 years ago this week, on August 1st, 1944. So thanks for allowing me that little aside, and let's jump back in now with Charlie Wilson's story. 75 years ago this week, he was busy serving with the 1503rd Air Transport Command in the Pacific. But when we left off, Charlie was sharing how he started to engage with the Army Air Corps' radio training as an 18-year-old.
So I figured, hey, this ain't half bad, so I went to school for it. And as I said, with the exception of the last course that I took in 85, that hypnosis thing, everything else was technical, math involved, and so I had a pretty good career after I got out, very, very good, with Hughes Aircraft. Well, I can go back even prior to that, because one of the companies I worked for back in Jersey, they were the ones that were very big in making guidance systems using state-of-the-art equipment. And that's gyroscopes, accelerometers, and you know, what the hell are those things? Well, a spinning wheel is a gyroscope, basically, that's all it is. And the accelerometers measure the speed and accelerations. Well, they were using that to use it as a navigation system. And the company that I worked for back there was really big on that. And in some cases, it can be relatively accurate, but nothing like GPS. GPS, I'm here and within 3 feet, that's where you are. But this thing had electronic drifts in it and things like that, where after a long flight, after maybe about a 2,000-3,000 mile flight, if you missed your target on the other end by a mile or two, you did very well, you know, because that's the accuracy of the equipment. Well, Hughes had a recruiting trip going back, and one of the specialties that they wanted was a gyroscope accelerometer guy who knew how they worked and, you know, whatever. And they bought that equipment for a local project here from exactly the same company I was working for. See? So they hired me out here. And I come out here and I find out that that was a piece of equipment that they were going to use on the very first Surveyor moon landing. But the moon landing that they had then was not manned. It was just to send out, and they sent the scoop, the arm scooped out, you know, and they scooped the dirt up to analyze it, and they had a camera mounted on the unit, and they could scan and see what the atmosphere looked like and that stuff, mostly just to collect some data. But they needed the guidance system, because when they're going to shoot this thing 200,000 miles, they knew that someplace halfway through or whatever, they're going to have to correct the course or they'll miss the moon completely. Well, they were using that equipment that I was working on back east, and they hired me in because I knew about them. Then the first thing they did, they sent me down on my desk, and they says, here, out like that. And I looked at it, and I said, oh, my God, where am I? California, back in Jersey. Yeah. And they fired it, and it worked out okay, and it did work the way it was supposed to. About halfway through, we were able to change the course, and then got the unit on the moon.
So just to be clear, you're telling me that the piece of equipment that you worked on helped get Apollo 11 accurately to the moon?
Well, 11 had its own numbers, but I went through the program we were on was called Surveyor, which was, they had a contract with NASA, I believe, to man, build, and send about four of these units up. Well, Unit 1, which is the one I worked on, made it, landed. Unit 2 crashed. Unit 3 landed, and 4 or 5, I think, crashed. And then, but they had enough data that they just cut it out, cut the program out. But just the basis on what they discovered, how the surface was and the atmosphere was and the temperature exchanges they had up there, like that probably helped design the Apollo series or any, even the Gemini series, which would be after that, because that first one was set up there was just to get the characteristics of the moon, the data. Sure. That's all they wanted it for. Yeah. But, you know, it's like you throwing a baseball from here to the moon, but you knew halfway through you got to bend it a little bit so it hits, otherwise it will whiz right on past. And it would have, too, unless the course was corrected about mid-course. And then my old accelerometers, you know, they did it. They wound them up, and it went.
Well, that's a pretty significant development. And I want to go further back. Speaking of significant developments, I ask every veteran I interview about December 7th, 1941, and I want to hear your memory of that. But I'm wondering if just because of where you were, if maybe just as big a deal back then was the Hindenburg.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't as big a deal as December 7th because the characteristics are different. I was a kid then when the Hindenburg went down, and to this day, I don't think anybody knows what blew it up. Some say static charge. Somebody says they lit a cigarette or whatever in that thing, and hydrogen goes very quickly. I mean, it's not like the helium that we use, which is non-flammable. So, I mean, it was a sight to see, I'll tell you that. I wasn't there at Lakewood myself, but they showed it on newsreels. They didn't have TV back then. So you had to wait for the newsreels to come out in the movies, and then you can see the Hindenburg coming down, and it came down quick, as I remember, within a half a minute, less than a minute, is when it completely was burned and the skeleton was on the ground.
Well, and I wonder, too, if even before December 7th, were you aware of the U-boat threat just off the Atlantic coast?
Yeah, only to the effect of how the newspapers would handle it, because we would get it and we'd read about it. But again, being a kid and you hear your folks talking about it, you know, that some spies came on board and they got them. They would have hanged those SOBs. They shouldn't be here. You know, that type of talk. You know, it was already in motion that they didn't want anybody around our shores that didn't belong there or without our consent, was the general attitude, as I recall it. And I just went on my merry way, went to school, you know, and my turn came to go into service. And I feel good about this. Man, I played the trick on the draft board.
Well, before we get to that, before I forget, too, tell me about December 7th, because you would have been only 15 years old. Where were you, and how'd you find out?
I remember going up into the house, and we had this majestic radio, big piece of furniture, and old radio, and I tuned it on because I wanted to listen to Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy, you know, which was coming over the air. And so I turned the thing on. I said, "We interrupt this program to say blah, 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 Japanese," you know, and I didn't even know where Japan was. But I learned pretty quick where it was. And so that's more or less how. And I think I know most of the people that I knew back then and most of the kids that I knew, all my own same age, all felt the same thing. This is fine. Okay, it's war, but war means you shoot and kill each other. But where's Japan? We found out, just about all of us on the whole street, the whole block, they were different times then than they are now. The attitudes were quite different because in general, what would happen is that these guys that came in and did that to us and the politicians and the big president and all that said that was bad, they should not have done it, they fired them. Nobody can do that to us. This is our country. We're going to sign up right away. And boy, they're telling you, everybody who came of age was down there at the signing up to do something. That's how patriotic they were. They didn't even know what it was for other than that guy blackened our eye and we're going to get even with it. And that's all. General attitude.
And yours too, even though you're only 15 and were too young?
Oh, I was too young to put on a uniform and fire a gun and all that. But I felt, what's this? These guys are coming down over here and they're, what are they doing? We're going to take care of that. But then I got a little smarter. I got a little older, a little not much older. Two years later, I ended up enlisting. And here I am.
Yeah, so let's hear this story. You said you pulled a fast one on the draft board. What happened there?
Now, back then, the draft board had the listings or they had the headcount of in the town or the local area that they were going to service of the eligible males. Eligible is 18 and older, whatever, 18 or 40 or something like that. That was their age bracket, and they knew how many were available. Right. But what the draft board would do is the various services would say, hey, I need this month, I need 15 guys. So the draft board would look, okay, my draft board for this section can give you 5. This guy will give you 5 until they get their quota. Various services, that's how they filled it, by just in the draft board. But if you enlisted, okay, you can pick your service, and the draft board gets credit for supplying a body. So I joined the Air Corps.
How old were you?
17. So I figure that's about the only time I ever pulled a fast one over the government. You disregard that statement.
So did that mean you had to have your mother sign for you?
Absolutely. And after much begging and pleading and all that stuff, she says, okay, all right, you'll be good like that. Now be careful. Okay, Ma, don't worry, I'll be careful.
Well, and most guys that I've interviewed who enlisted in the Army Air Corps did it because they really wanted to be pilots. Was that the case for you? Did you have that idea in your head?
Yeah, when I signed up, I signed up for what they call pilot training, and you go to a multitude of tests. Fact is, if I remember rightly, I signed up in West New York, draft board, but I had to go into New York City to get the special physical, and I made it all the way through until the last test, which was my eye test. I wore glasses, but very thin ones, you know, just whatever. Oh, no, if you're gonna fly, no, pilots, no, you got to have 20/20 with plane vision, without wind. However, because you are right on the borderline, we can set you up to go and be a crew member, be something else, but not to drive the airplane. Yeah. So I never got to drive the airplane.
But, as you've already shared, what you did in the Army Air Corps influenced your career after World War II, so maybe that was a fortunate turn.
Oh, without a doubt, because as I was saying, what I told you earlier, it was quite extensive. The radio school was actually I'm chuckling because every time I think about it, I think, how did I ever end up there? Sioux Falls, South Dakota in the wintertime. Even Lawrence Welk bailed out of that. Well, you know, so you get by it.
So what kind of stuff did you learn there?
Oh, how to repair these various types of radio equipment, how to operate it, and how to use it in the air. Because all this equipment we were talking about, that we were talking about here, ended up on aircraft, all kinds of aircraft. The C-47s, affectionately known as the Goonie Bird, and the C-54s, which are the next larger ones from a transport point of view. Fact is, if I can regress slightly, the C-54, commercially I think it was called the DC-4, but I don't know if it ever got into commercial use. But in the Berlin airlift, when you see those, and when they show you these pictures of these four-engine planes coming into Tempelhof, that's a C-54. So just to let your people know, that's what it is. And it's been around, at least I crewed in them back in 44, 45, after the C-47s. So they've been around for a while.
And, you know, when we talk about World War II aircraft, so much of the attention goes to the fighters or the bombers. And some people aren't even aware of the giant role that the other planes played and these transport planes that you served on. But what about you at the time? As you're going through radio school and training, I mean, did you have a thought in your head of what kind of planes you wanted to fly on?
Yeah, I was enamored with the Air Force, what they call the B-26. And that was the only plane that they made look like a flying cigar. It really did. It was a very fast aircraft. It could almost dogfight, but it couldn't because it was obviously too heavy. But it had a lot of speed, a lot of agility, and it was the B-26. But I never got to that. They figured that, okay, we got enough of whatever they have, and we're going to put you on these kind of airplanes. Okay, at least I was flying, and that was the main thing, and operating my radio sets. I'll tell you an interesting story. I had occasion to go out to my grandson lives in Midland, Texas, and I was out there last year. And in order to keep Grandpa busy, didn't want to leave him hanging around and be bored out of his mind, so they had a local air museum there. So they take me over, and they're going to bring me in the air museum and let me look. And I'll be darned. I go in the hangar, and the very first aircraft I see is the model, partially stripped down. The whole cockpit was there, and part of the cargo bay was there, of what appeared to be the aircraft that I crewed on.
You mean the actual model number and everything?
Oh, yeah, and even my squadron number.
Well, we all want to hear the rest of that story, but it's break time again, so hold that thought for me. Much more to come with 93-year-old Charlie Wilson of Bakersfield, California. Next June, he's going to celebrate 70 years of marriage with his wife, Marie. Don't forget to head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for a short video and photos relating to Charlie's story, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is Charlie Wilson, 93 years old, of Bakersfield, California, originally from West New York, New Jersey. And we're going to hear about what might have been Charlie's closest call in a moment, but that hometown of West New York was definitely on his mind when he visited the National World War II Memorial with Honor Flight Kern County.
gazing out at that wall of gold stars representing the more than 406,000 Americans who were killed during World War II, Charlie couldn't help but think of his childhood friend Carmen DeDio. You know, Charlie and his transport crews helped keep many wounded soldiers alive, both by evacuating them from battle zones and by delivering medical supplies to those areas. But there was nothing Charlie or anyone could do for his friend Carmen, who was killed while fighting in the Pacific with the 1st Marine Division. Honor Flight was such a powerful experience for Charlie, but he was talking about a different trip when we left off. At the CAF Air Power Museum in Midland, Texas, you said you found a C-47 that you thought you might have actually flown in during World War II?
Yeah, it says this aircraft was used in 1503rd ATC unit, the 1504th ATC unit, and I was in those two. And then they had the troop carrier or something else that listed down there, and I'm looking up saying, now, the only way I could identify that was the actual plane that I was on is if I knew what the tail number was, I could look at it and see what it was. And then there was one thing that would really verified it. I looked at the radio operator position where we had the desk down there, and I looked around to see if I could find my initials that I carved in there when I was flying.
Did you find them?
No. Somebody must have changed it. You know, it's a small desk, and it's made of wood, and that's where the key is that they have down in there to send the Morse code with. And I'm looking around there to see. I know I put it here somewhere. Well, underneath on top, you know, I couldn't find it. If I would have found it, that would have cinched it. That was the actual plane I flew in.
Wow. Well, sounds like it was pretty close.
Yeah.
And let's hear about that unit that you ended up with, the 1503rd Air Transport Command. What does that mean? What did you guys do? What were you responsible for?
Well, the Air Transport Command is what it says. Back then, if you had to move cargo, move wounded, move people, it didn't matter. You were transporting, and that's exactly what the saying said. And the symbol they had on there looks like some kind of a globe with a spear on it. But that's all it was. It was the part of the Air Force that did the transport work, the cargo carrying, the wounded carrying, and even people carrying. If they were going to get a general from here and there, just as a sidebar, every now and again, if you see on TV or you're watching your show on TV and you see the plane that MacArthur pulled in on and he gets out of the plane, comes down, that's a C-54. And that's kind of like their private planes that they drive around with. So, and it was part of the Air Transport Command that furnished this type of an aircraft to these various notaries and cargo and things like that.
So how old were you when you first were sent overseas?
Yeah, 18, give and take a little.
And how many guys were on your crew? And what, were you in a C-47 then?
Yeah, C-47 was the first ones I went on. And we had a crew of one, two, three, five. And we also had the same amount on a 54. It's a five-man crew because we had the pilot, co-pilot, radio, and the chief engineer, and the cargo guy. And it turned out to be that the airplane driver, once you learn how to drive a car, you can drive an airplane, so to speak. But the cargo guy was very important. If he didn't lay out the weights of the cargo on the inside the fuselage, that plane would fly cattywampus, nose too high, tail too high, because it's amazing how the weight distribution in the fuselage can actually affect the attitude of the plane while it's flying, you know? And so he's very important. I mean, oh, yeah. Yeah, the old cargo guy, he'd go out there and make sure he'd know what the weights are, you know, for they have the weight on the cargo that they'd stencil on it, and they'd say, okay, that goes here, and he'd look it out, and he says, okay, we're ready to go. And also, that also being the cargo guy, that he also takes into account the weight of the gasoline and where it is with respect to the center of gravity of the aircraft, so the thing at least flies level, which is very important, by the way.
And what about your role? What all were you responsible for?
I was responsible for all the radio equipment on board. Now, I'm trying to think. We had the transmitter, the high-power transmitter. Then we had the radio receiver, which would take that. Then we had the, on board the planes, we had the interplane and from aircraft to ground and from aircraft to aircraft. There was a special piece of equipment for that. And then we had on board the radio compass, which is, I told you about that. That's the most, to me and the rest of the crew, that's the most important piece of equipment on board.
Well, why don't you explain to everybody listening why that is, why that made you so popular, that you had access and control of that?
Okay, yeah, this is always a small story. The radio equipment that's on board the planes that we're talking about, beacons, of course, I rode the beacon too. That's the other saying we had. When you're flying and you're on these long flights and there isn't much you can do, but the radio compass was the only radio equipment that would pick up broadcast, commercial broadcast bands that would lie all through the United States and all various, especially in the United States, all the broadcast frequencies. So when we were flying, and you get these long flights, you know, 4 hours or more, 5 hours, and it gets awful boring up there. So I would turn on the radio compass. Not that I ought to know where we were going. I knew where we were going. So I'm looking for a radio station I could pick up that had some programs going that we all knew about, like Tommy Dorsey playing his music, Jimmy Dorsey, Doris Day, Fibber McGee and Molly. I don't know how he kept all that stuff in that closet. Every time he'd open up the closet door, everything come pouring out, you know. And so the guys on board the plane, they all wanted to hear that kind of stuff. After all, there's nothing to do for 4 hours. I mean, you sleep a little and, you know, you get there and you make sure that your plane is going the way it's supposed to. So I'd crank in the station and I'd tell the guys, okay, switch your boxes over to compass and listen. And that's why that made me very, very popular on board that aircraft.
So you guys would be in the middle of the Pacific somewhere, and you're picking up a radio signal from, what, San Francisco or LA or something?
San Francisco. Actually, the only stations that we could get very reliably were Seattle, Washington, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Honolulu, and San Diego. They were the high-power stations. And they were about the only places that we could reach anyway. Everybody else was on the other side of the world, and I didn't understand Japanese very well. Well, but just as a sidebar, Japanese very well. The one thing I always wanted to do, but I could never find her, and that's to listen to Tokyo Rose. But I could never find out what frequency he was on. And I could have picked it up because I said I had enough equipment to cover that band. Yeah. I could just never get her.
Where was the first place you were sent to operate out of? Where would you guys go from there? And what kind of cargo were you transporting?
Well, most of the cargo that we would carry were engine parts, drums of special oils and fluids, actual drums, 50-gallon drums that you see around, medical supplies. And I don't know if I could say this over the air, but... Because it's the truth of the matter, and you can, and if I say it, it's okay. I mean, I don't think I'm breaking any rules. But the most common piece of equipment, cargo, that was asked for by most of the people that we landed at, and the cargo guys had come and unloaded, and that was toilet paper.
Well, it's kind of in thin supply in the jungle.
Yeah. We got two cases for you here. Okay, that's fine. And then they offload the stuff and distribute it down. They're supposed to, some guys getting the engine parts, some of the car parts, or whatever they require, you know, to keep things flying and keep things repaired. And
all those flights in World War II, did you ever have to parachute out of a plane?
Once. Some of that ground fire shot us down. And it was in a 47, C-47.
You weren't going to tell me about that?
I didn't think about it until you said the buzzword. I got so much crap in my head, and I'm so damn old that I operate on buzzwords. You say a buzzword, and something will pop out. If you don't, nothing pops out.
Okay, so where was this that you guys got shot down?
Yeah, it was coming out of Clark Field, which is outside of Manila.
Uh-huh.
And ground fire, just... ping, 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 and to this day, I don't know why we had to bail. I suspect very strongly that what had happened, that the hydraulic system got shot out or something else like that. It doesn't take much to punch holes in the hydraulic lines, you know. And so all five of us got out. We just, over you go.
And where did you come down?
It was in Luzon, which is Now, if I remember rightly, I don't know the exact mileage, but Clark Air Force Base is in Manila vicinity, about maybe 70, 80 miles north of it. So it's all jungle up there still. So we come down just a little bit north of Clark Field.
But it was friendly territory?
At that time, yeah. Because the guys that were fighting in there was the 1st Cavalry. And so we come on down, and they kind of cut us loose and all that stuff and said, okay, go on home now. We saved you, you know, type of attitude. But it was okay.
Is that a little scary, jumping out of an airplane because you have to?
Well, I tell you, we had to, let's put it this way, we had to abandon the aircraft. We were told to get out. It's a good thing I wasn't last out. I must have been third or fourth like that, because I remember to this day, I'm at the door, I'm looking down, and I feel somebody's booting my butt, and over I went. I'd still be up there looking at the ground.
That's a close enough call. I'm glad we covered that. But the reason I was asking if you ever jumped out of one in the war is because I know you did so more recently, because Honor Flight Kern County had a little fundraiser out in Taft, California. You actually went skydiving?
Yeah. Yeah, it was skydive. It was about 2 years ago. I was 91 when I jumped at that time. Yeah, so it had to be 2 years ago. So anyway, so the thing that happened there was that, so down we came, you know, and all pictures were taken. Oh, I mean, I tell you, everybody was there because this was unheard of. A whole bunch of old guys. Okay, I was the oldest of the group, but the youngest was 85 or 6, but we were old guys going to jump out of an airplane. Ah, come on. What's the matter? These guys should be home in rocking chairs, you know. So the three of us, we signed up. We said, what the hell? So we go up and we're outside of here, Taft. And just as a side issue on that one, on that day, Shannon Grove, our representative here, and Judy McCarthy, Kevin's wife, they were at that day with the rest of us there. When they saw us old guys, they said, we can do that. And so they suited up and they jumped. They really did. They jumped that day with the rest of us, you know, up in the plane.
Well, what did that feel like? I mean, not too many 91-year-olds get that thrill.
Well, it's the first step is a beaut. You know, but after that, it's just like sitting in the chair here and you got the controls of the, because it's not a regular round parachute like you had in the old days. This is a parasail. It looks like a wing, yeah. You know, and you can control the places where you're going to go as you come down. And so, but I made the perfect landing as per the book. At least they tell me this afterward. I came down, I tripped somehow or another. And it's a good thing we landed on the grass instead of the runway, because I went down on my butt and I slid down as far as you can go. Just smiling and happy as I'm sliding on my butt on the grass. And they got it on picture to show me.
Well, I guess I have to ask you the million-dollar question. Which parachute jump did you enjoy more? Out of a damaged airplane in World War II or out of a perfectly good airplane in 2017?
Perfectly good airplane. Well, you know, mainly the thing was is that the guy that, I don't know what you call him. I call him a driver, my parachute driver, okay?
Yeah.
He's on your back.
Tandem jump, yeah.
It was a tandem jump. So he says, before we go up, he says, now the parachute's got two handles hanging off on the end of the wing now. You can steer the parachute with it. You want to go to the left, just pull down on the left one a little bit, and it'll go that way as you're coming down. You want to go to the right, go like so, you know. And so I'm playing with it. I like that. I'm having a good time with this thing up there, you know. But boy, what a landing I made.
And we have some links to coverage of that then 91-year-old Charlie Wilson skydiving a couple years ago, linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and it's on the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. You might even recognize another one of the vets who jumped that day, David Crawford, who's also shared his story here on the radio. So that was a couple years ago, Charlie, but I know one thing you continue to do today is go to local schools and help educate young people about World War II. So when they ask you, what's World War II and why does it still matter today, how do you answer that?
Well, I try to bring it down to their level and I say why it matters is because if I didn't go or people like me didn't go, you wouldn't be sitting there asking me that question. I think that something like that gets them to think a little bit more about it. It's not too deep, but they can understand. I think they understand what I just said.
Well, I'm pretty sure we all understand what you just said, and I want to make sure I say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for sharing your unique story with us today, and keep sharing it with all those young people. Who knows? Maybe they'll tell you they heard you on the radio, and they went and tried your special Depression-era coffee trick. Charlie Wilson, 93 years old. And that's all the time we have today, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.